Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for words and their stories and people in America, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we report on a new study from South Korea that predicts the country will be empty by the year 2750, unless people there start having larger families. And we will report on predictions that more immigrants are headed north from Central America to the United States. Those are our stories today on As It Is. South Korea's National Assembly Research Service says no one will be living in the country by 2750 if women there do not start having more children. Last year, the birth rate was 1.19 children for every woman. The Research Service report says the country's population will decrease from 50 million to 10 million by 2136 if the rate does not increase. The report says the population will continue to drop to 3 million by 2200 and to only 1 million by 2256. The research shows the country will be empty by 2750 if there is no change. The report predicts the southern port city of Busan would be the first city to empty. It predicts 2413 as the year the last person will be born in the city. It says the capital, Seoul, will have its final birth in 2505. According to the CIA Factbook, only one country and three major territories have a lower birth rate than South Korea. They are Singapore, Macau, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. Many Asian and European countries face dropping birth rates like South Korea. Japan's birth rate is recorded at 1.4 per woman, while Germany is a little higher at 1.43. The fall in birth rate is a more serious problem for Asian countries like South Korea and Japan, where fewer immigrants arrive and fill in for the lost native population. In July, the Chosun Ilbo newspaper reported on a study by the Korea Institute for Industrial Economics and Trade. The study predicted the country's population competitiveness among the 29 member nations of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It said it would go from 17th place in 2010 to 21st place in 2030. The main reason for the drop is the fast growth of the country's aging population. Fewer children means the country must put in place a higher tax rate to support government payments to older people. This weakens the country's economy. The Wall Street Journal notes that South Korea began urging women to have fewer children in the early 1960s, during the presidency of Park Chung-hee. His oldest child, Park Geun-hye, is now the president. She has no children. Since last October, tens of thousands of children have entered the United States without a parent or legal guardian. This was two times the number as the year before. Methodist Pastor Jacer Davila meets many Central American immigrants in the Mexican city of Nuevo Laredo. The city lies just south of the U.S. city of Laredo, Texas. Ann Ball picks up the story from there.
Pastor Davila's humanitarian relief group helps the Central Americans. The immigrants say more people are now traveling to the United States from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. These people will soon arrive at the U.S. border. At a shelter, the migrants tell Pastor Davila they know other people who are traveling to the border. They also hope their families will be able to join them as soon as possible. The clergyman believes this is true because he hears this information so often. The number of Central Americans arrested at the U.S. border reached an all-time high in June. Border Patrol guards arrested many adults and children. They were released because there was no room to detain them. Others surrendered and were taken to an immigration court. They were then released, but told to return at a later date. In McAllen, Texas, Sister Norma Pimentel has been busy for months dealing with the Central American immigrants. She operates a center for Catholic Charities of the Rio Grande Valley. Recently, the center helped 70 immigrants in one day. But Sister Pimentel said she has not heard that more immigrants are on their way.
They don't know when people are coming, and we don't know either. You know, it could very well be that maybe in October or later on we might have a great numbers of people. I think Border Patrol expects numbers to increase in the near future, but you know, we have no clue as to what's going to happen.
Shelter and immigrant aid workers think about the things that cause people to cross the border at certain times of the year. Some possible reasons are weather conditions, school schedules, and criminal activity. However, none of them expected the increase in immigrants this year. Sarah Melendez works with U.S. Customs and Border Patrol in Laredo, Texas. She said her office has not heard about another increase in immigrants.
That's our program for today. I hope it has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Cruz. Please join us again tomorrow for another edition of As It Is, here on the Voice of America.
Words and Their Stories is next, followed by People in America. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
I'm Susan Clark with Words and Their Stories, a program in special English on the Voice of America. Almost every language in the world has a saying that a person can never be too rich. Americans, like people in other countries, always want more money. One way they express this is by protesting that their jobs do not pay enough. A common expression is, "I am working for chicken feed." It means working for very little money. The expression probably began because seeds fed to chickens made people think of small change. Small change means metal coins of not much value, like nickels, which are worth 5 cents. An early use of the word chicken feed appeared in an American publication in 1930. It told about a rich man and his son. Word expert Mitford Matthews says it read, "I'll bet neither the kid nor his father ever saw a nickel or a dime. They would not have been interested in such chicken feed." Chicken feed also has another interesting meaning known to history experts and World War II spies and soldiers. Spy expert Henry S. A. Beckett writes that some German spies working in London during the war also worked for the British. The British government had to make the Germans believe their spies were working. So British officials gave them mostly false information. It was called chicken feed. The same person who protests that he is working for chicken feed may also say, "I am working for peanuts." She means she is working for a small amount of money. It is a very different meaning from the main one in the dictionary. That meaning is small nuts that grow on a plant. No one knows for sure how a word for something to eat also came to mean something very small. But a peanut is a very small food. The expression is an old one. Word expert Mitford Matthews says that as early as 1854, an American publication used the words peanut agitators. That meant political troublemakers who did not have a lot of support. Another reason for the saying about working for peanuts may be linked to elephants. Think of how elephants are paid for their work in the circus. They receive food, not money. One of the foods they like best is peanuts. When you add the word gallery to the word peanut, you have the name of an area in an American theater. A gallery is a high seating area or balcony above the main floor. The peanut gallery got its name because it is the part of the theater most distant from where the show takes place. So peanut gallery tickets usually cost less than other tickets. People pay a small amount of money for them. This special English program, Words and Their Stories, was written by Jerry Watson. This is Susan Clark.
I'm Shirley Griffith.
And I'm Rich Kleinfeld with the special English program, People in America. Today, we begin the story of 20th century poet Robert Frost.
In 1961, John Kennedy was sworn in as President of the United States. He asked one of America's best-known writers to read a poem. Robert Frost stood in the cold sunlight that day, his white hair blowing in the wind. He read these words from his poem, The Gift Outright.
The land was ours before we were the land's. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out that it was ourselves we were withholding from our land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war to the land vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become.
Robert Frost was one of America's best-known and most honored serious writers. But his fame came late in his life. He was 40 years old before Americans began to read his poems and praise them. Once his fame was established, however, it grew stronger and stronger during the rest of his long life. His success came from uniting traditional forms of poetry with American words, spoken in a clearly American way.
Frost used the same speaker for many poems, so the separate poems formed a larger unity. He created this speaker carefully. He felt that his readers would believe his poems if he put the words into the mouth of a wise person who lived in the country, not the city. Many people thought the speaker was Frost himself. In fact, the speaker was an imaginary person. Frost, the man, tried to become the imaginary person he created for his poetry.
Robert Frost is always linked to the land of cold winters in the northeastern United States, the area called New England. Yet he came from the other side of the country, San Francisco, California. He was born there in 1874. He lived in California during his early childhood. This man who was born in the West and became linked with New England was named for the chief Southern general in America's Civil War. The general's name was Robert E. Lee. The poet was named Robert Lee Frost because his father wanted to honor the general. Someone once asked another American writer, Ernest Hemingway, how to become a writer. The best thing, he said, was to have an unhappy childhood. If this is true, Robert Frost's childhood was unhappy enough to make him a very good writer.
Robert Frost's father was a reporter who wanted to be a politician. He often drank too much alcohol and became angry. Robert was the victim of his anger. He was 11 when his father died. His mother tried to protect him from his father's anger. Some people think she protected him too much. As a child, Robert was afraid of the dark. All his life, he suffered from imaginary sicknesses.
Frost's mother was from New England. After her husband died, she moved back there. She supported her children by teaching school, yet she got more enjoyment from reading and writing poetry. Frost finished high school in 1891. He and a girl, Eleanor White, had the best record of the students graduating that year. He married Eleanor 3 years later. She rejected him at first, but finally agreed to marry him. This rejection led to a lack of trust in their marriage. It made Frost say this, "I could lose everything and not be surprised."
After high school, Frost's grandfather offered to pay his costs at Dartmouth College. Frost left the school after a few months. He did not like it. He spent the next few years working at different jobs. At one time, he worked in a factory. Later, he repaired shoes. He was a teacher. He was a reporter. Always, he wrote poetry.
Frost attended Harvard University for 2 years. After that, he returned to the many jobs he held before, and he continued to write poetry. He said that until 1913, he earned only about $10 a year from writing. For a while, Frost tried to take care of a farm in the state of New Hampshire. He was not a successful farmer. During this time of working and traveling from job to job, he and his wife had 4 children. Since he earned very little money, his family was always poor.
Robert Frost saw himself becoming more and more like his father, treating his family badly. He became very unhappy with himself and with his life. He even thought about ending his life. In 1912, he decided to try to make a new start. He took his family to Britain. The cost of living was low, and there was an interest in what was then called a new poetry. In Britain, Frost found a publisher for his first book of poems. The book was called A Boy's Will. When it appeared in 1913, Frost received high praise from British readers. Praise was something he had not received in his own country. Ezra Pound, another American poet living in Britain, read the poems and liked them very much. He wrote a magazine report about Frost. He also helped get Frost's second book of poems published in America. That book was called North of Boston.
Many readers consider North of Boston to be Frost's best book of poems. In Britain, it was praised even more than his first book. Readers saw the way he took simple material and constructed from it a world of new meanings. They saw the way he spoke with a voice that sounded like common speech. What they failed to see was the differences Frost found between what was seen and the person doing the seeing. This was what he called the outer and inner weather. In 1915, both of Frost's books were published in the United States. He felt that his books had gone home, and he should go home too. When he reached America, he was surprised by the praise he received and the acceptance of American publishers. In the words of the poem he read at President Kennedy's inauguration many years later, the land was his before he was the land's.
When Robert Frost returned to America from Britain, he bought another farm in New Hampshire. To feed himself and his family, he depended on the sales of his books and papers. He also earned money by speaking at universities. Success did not ease his life, and it did not change the way he thought and acted. The gentle, wise person who spoke from his poems was the man Frost wanted to be. He knew, however, and his family knew, he was not that man. Tragic events affected him. His son killed himself. His wife was often sick, and his daughter became mentally sick. Frost, too, suffered from his own imaginary sicknesses. Through his poems, however, he lived a different life.
Frost was a worker in words, a craftsman. He tried to capture exactly the speech of the people of New England. He used simple descriptions that were easily understood. He talked about simple, natural things. Trees, the weather, the seasons, night and day. In an early poem, he wrote,
I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come, too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come, too.
Robert Frost said that reading his poems should begin with pleasure and end in wisdom. Yet as he grew older, his simple idea of the world became more difficult. His world was more touched with sadness. He knew more about fear, about being alone, about losing whatever he had. We will continue our story of American poet Robert Frost next week.
This special English program was written by Richard Thorman. It was produced by Christine Johnson. I'm Rich Kleinfeld.
And I'm Shirley Griffith. Join us again next week for another program about people in America on VOA.